This is Main Street on Pray Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and as we mentioned, we have a new name, a little new music, some other changes to share with you as well, and I'll be talking with Ashley Thornburg at the end of our hour for Main Street about some of those changes and about her contributions coming up as well. Later on our program, we're going to talk about designer genes with an NDSU biochemistry professor because there's an awful lot of interesting research being done in that area. We'll also hear, of course, from Tom Ezer, an NDSU history professor. He's always got an interesting Plain Folk column. And every day we do Dakota Datebook with Merrill Pepcorn. But first, it's tax season in North Dakota and everywhere in the United States. So it's time to get an update from the man who knows more about it than anybody in the state of North Dakota, and that's Corey Fong. He is the tax commissioner. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Doug. It's great to be here. So taxes and designer jeans. Boy, that's quite the combo.
Well, and we've got some great news about taxes. We'll get into that because
right.
The state has been raising revenue in recent years.
Yep.
First of all, though, are there any significant changes people should be aware of in this particular tax season?
You know, Doug, not so many, actually. Most of the changes are at the federal level. We did get off to a bit of a slow start this year because of some of the federal tax changes coming in late. And so the federal e-file program didn't start on time this year. So we're actually behind a little bit in terms of total returns that have been filed so far. But we'll catch up. Obviously, people need to get their taxes in. And we know that it's just a matter of timing. But we'll probably have about 410,000 to 420,000 total returns come in this season by the time we get to the extension deadline, which is in October. But we're up, obviously, over previous years because, A, we've got more people in the state and they're filing returns, and we've got more workers in the state, mobile workers who are earning income in North Dakota. So they'll all come in. It's going really well so far. The season is about average. I don't see that there's anything that's really unusual. And as usual, we're trying to get the word out as we are approaching about a month out that it's time to start thinking about it. And one of the best sources for learning about filing your taxes and the resources available is our website. And so we like to tell people to start there. I always feel badly for the taxpayer who gets all the way through filing their federal return with one provider, an online provider, for example, and then find out that that online provider does not support North Dakota forms.
Ouch.
And they have to start all over again. So the best way to avoid that is really start with our website. We have all of the providers that support North Dakota forms. And in some cases, there are tax providers. Online providers that provide a free service, depending on your income or if you've served in the military or if you are able to take advantage of some federal tax treatment. So there are some free ways to have your taxes prepared out there, to include the program that I'm visiting Fargo today is the Tax Counseling for the Elderly program, which is a free service for taxpayers as well.
You mentioned the federal government was a little late doing this and that. Is sequestration going to affect the tax collection process this year?
Well, I don't know if it's going to affect the tax collection process. I mean, there's so much discussion right now about, you know, the effects on certain agencies and certain agencies shutting down and those that shouldn't shut down. I haven't heard from, you know, anyone from the IRS that that's going to affect the processing of returns. But, you know, I'm kind of out of the loop on that. But as far as the delays that I'm speaking of, I'm talking about some of those late end of the year changes that were made that were difficult for the IRS to program and some of the online providers to get ready for. So that's why the delay. But really no major changes at the state level.
So for North Dakota tax information, what's the website people should go to?
Our website is nd.gov/tax, and everything that you want to know is out on our website. And the number to call would be 877-328-7088 if you're looking for information. But our website really is the best place to start. And one thing that we've done in the last couple of years, Doug, is we've developed a portal. And by answering some very basic, intuitive kinds of questions, the taxpayer is going to be served up the best filing option for them. So if you qualify for a free service, it's going to say, hey, here's a free service and here's all that are available to you. Mm. If you don't qualify for a free service, it's going to show you all the online providers and software vendors that support North Dakota forms. The other thing that we've done is recognizing that some taxpayers will be able to find a free solution to file their federal return, but not the state return. We do have a free fillable form. It can be submitted electronically online, and so there is a way for you to file your state return for free, and it's very simple. It does require you to put your information in once again into the system, but it's a very good system. It's easy to follow, and so we encourage taxpayers to consider that. But my point is that our website provides a variety of solutions for the taxpayer to consider when they're starting this process.
And I went up and poked around it, found lots of information, including frequently asked questions, which kind of helps to, you know, second guess, I guess, if you will, of the typical questions that people are going to be asking. What are the most common mistakes people make? I suspect math and maybe forgetting to sign the form, but what are the others?
Math is always an issue for the paper return, but that's why electronically filing is so great, because those programs, whether they're online or something off the shelf, typically the math is all corrected. You can't work your way through some of the online providers or off-the-shelf programs unless you complete all the information. So that's why we always kind of promote electronic filing, because it is difficult to make mistakes. But some of the other common mistakes, you know, taxpayers will forget to sign. That seems to be the most common. They'll sign, but maybe their spouse won't. Or we've even had taxpayers who put their federal return in the state envelope and vice versa, and so that creates a problem.
Ouch.
But, you know, those are common mistakes. But again, a lot of times electronic filing kind of eliminates most of those errors because of the checking that it does as you go through the program.
What's the percentage of people who do electronically file now?
Well, that's exciting to answer for me, because we've been working at this for so long. But 80%. When I started as tax commissioner in 2005, we were about 45%. So we've come a long ways. And again, we think it's good for the taxpayer. It's efficient. They avoid errors. They are able to make sure that they're maximizing credits and deductions that they might miss if they were filing a paper return. And so there are many benefits for the taxpayer, but for us, of course, it's the efficiency. I was at our processing center last week, which at one time, years ago, was just, you know, teeming with volunteer or with temporary staff.
Sure.
Who were processing and opening and you know, pulling out staples and all of that. And now we're down to just a small skeleton crew of folks who are opening the few paper returns that we do receive. I suspect we'll probably be increasing e-file a little bit this cycle, but probably not too much. I think we've probably saturated, hit that, you know, plateau as far as how many taxpayers are filing electronically, but we still like to promote it.
Well, we have tens of thousands of new workers in the state and more coming every day. So we need to get the word out, I suppose, that they have to pay state taxes if they're living in North Dakota. We might want to...
And if they're doing work in North Dakota, you know, that's one of the things that we want to make sure. I mean, we've got a lot of new folks living here. And
tax
of course,
compliance issues.
That's right. And they live here and they have a tax filing requirement. But there are workers that are coming in and out of the state. They might live in Houston or Denver and they come in and do 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off. Those folks are earning income in North Dakota and they have a tax filing obligation too. So, matter of fact, just recently, one of the things we've been trying to do is get the word out through social media. So we've got a Facebook page and we've got YouTube videos. And one of our YouTube videos that we released is specific to taxpayers who are new to the state and maybe not realizing they have a filing obligation. And so, you know, that's one of the things that we want to do is make sure and educate those folks and let them know that they do have a requirement. And social media is just one more vehicle to do that.
Well, in the meantime, they're typically working for companies that are deducting the state tax, aren't they?
True, absolutely. Withholding is our best compliance tool, quite frankly, because mandatory withholding where their wages are being withheld. And so, you know, that's certainly part of it. You know, you mentioned compliance. Right now at the tax department, with all this growth, this economic growth statewide, that is one of the areas where we're really focusing our attention, because we have a lot of new businesses out there. And for the most part, those businesses are just doing their job. And we want to remind them that they have some compliance requirements as far as taxes. And there's a whole host of other agencies that they need to deal with as well. So that's one of our challenges, is getting the word out about registering for sales tax and withholding, making sure that you know, they're following the rules and making sure their employees know what their obligations are too.
Well, let's jump into the really good news about the revenue that's coming in, because I went online and took a look at the 2012 Red Book. That's kind of an organized look at all the statistics that tie into revenue growth in the state or revenue reporting. And you basically use the word extraordinary growth in your cover letter. As the state with the lowest unemployment rate in the nation, North Dakota added nearly 60,000 jobs in the last decade. That's in your letter. Wages and personal incomes are growing faster than any other state, placing North Dakota in the top spot as number one in personal income and per capita personal income growth. And recently, the annual 24/7 Wall Street study ranked North Dakota as the best-run state in the nation. All that money helps, doesn't it?
It does. We certainly have received a number of kudos and accolades over the past year. And, you know, one thing that I like to point out in all of this is actually the growth has been quite steady for a long time. You know, when I started as tax commissioner in 2005, we started to see kind of this long-term upward mobility of our tax receipts. Taxable sales and purchases is one measurement of that. We release taxable sales and purchases on a quarterly and annual basis. And really that goes back to 2003. We've got several years of continued growth in taxable sales and purchases, and it's been statewide. It hasn't been just West, although that's where we've seen some of the largest growth lately in communities like Williston and Dickinson and Minot. But, you know, Fargo, Grand Forks, communities in the Valley, too, have seen double-digit growth in their taxable sales and purchases as well. So we like to point out that this has been kind of a steady growth pattern for quite some time. And just in the last several years since the boom has taken off, the oil boom, have we really seen it kind of this spike. But it's been good news. It's been good times for our state.
And in kind of in the best of both worlds thing here, the income has actually gone up for across the state, but the income tax rate has gone down a bit, but still the revenue is up.
And yet we're collecting more revenue. And yeah. I think that's a very good point, Doug, that you point out that, you know, that has been part of our effort, I think, at the state level for quite some time. The legislature is dealing with that right now is, you know, reducing income tax rates when you can. Growing the tax base, bringing more people in, more businesses, because we have a favorable business climate, and that's going to raise revenue. And I think that that has been a good plan for us. The same is true with property taxes. We've been able to reduce property taxes or provide property tax savings to taxpayers for the last several years, and I think that's been a good thing too. We're probably the only state, Doug, that's really been talking in the last several legislative cycles about tax relief versus the other, the flip side of it, which so many states are having to deal with growing their revenue because of cuts and reducing revenues for a variety of reasons. Minnesota, our neighbors to the east, are dealing with that right now as they're trying to make up for a shortfall, and so they're completely overhauling their tax system.
Have you received any guidance whatsoever from the governor or the legislature about what might be happening to income taxes or property taxes this year?
Oh, absolutely. I wouldn't say it's guidance. I think it's more or less we have a discussion.
Hope so. But
we are obviously very involved in the legislative process, and so we track the proposals closely. Right now, there are about three major vehicles for income tax relief, both individual and corporate, and actually banking taxes. And then, of course, individuals also are going to benefit from income tax relief. Property taxes, again, front and center this legislative session. I can guarantee that they're going to come out of this legislative session with additional property tax savings to taxpayers along with more income tax cuts. It's just at what level, I don't know. But I think it's going to be emerging on $1 billion+ worth of property and income tax relief coming out of this session. So again, going back to what I said earlier, we're in a very, I think, enviable spot in North Dakota where we're talking about still growing our revenues but providing tax relief to our citizens. And so, yes, we get very involved in that. Every proposal, every tax proposal, Doug, requires some kind of analysis from our agency. And some of those that, for example, cut rates or provide new deductions or new credits, all of them have to be analyzed from a fiscal perspective. And so we put kind of like a score. It's called a fiscal note and say this is what the cost of the bill is going to be. This is how much revenue is going to reduce or increase as a result of the proposal. So we're very engaged in the legislative process.
Well, if you look at this Red Book information, and it's just rich. It's got 140 pages worth of data, actually. You can see that the total general fund revenues 10 years ago was about $1.7 billion. For the projected biennium we're currently in, it's closing in on $5 billion.
Right, exactly. That's just the general fund.
Yeah.
That's just the general fund. So all the taxes that we collect that end up outside the general fund, like motor fuels taxes and oil and gas taxes, which we some in some cases redistribute, you know, we're talking closer to $10-plus billion that the agency will collect for the this biennium that we're in, and it's going to be even stronger than that for the 2013-15 biennium. So we are, you know, that's why in my cover letter we talk about extraordinary times. These are historic times for the state of North Dakota. And it's exciting. It's a time of great change, but it also creates some challenges too. Good challenges, of course, but that's why I think there's so much, you know, there's so much pressure on the legislature right now, because they're really going to be charting the course for the next decade or two for North Dakota. And so the decisions they make have such significant consequences. As you mentioned, as we were visiting, sometimes it's almost difficult, more difficult to have a lot of money because the decisions, the consequences are so great and the pressure is so great. But they do a good job, and this is my 10th legislative session, believe it or not, and I just have great pride in the good work the legislature does. It's not easy work, but it's important work.
I'm thinking in times when you don't have any money, people don't ask because they know that. And in times when you got a lot of money, people ask because they want their piece of it.
That's right, and making those decisions about what do you fund and what you don't fund. Those are critical decisions. Right now, as you well know, there's so much discussion about the infrastructure needs out west.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's going to be a major discussion yet for the second half of the session. There's a proposal out there to dedicate approximately $500 million more just through the distribution formula to the 17 oil and gas producing counties. That's a significant proposal. That will ultimately deliver about $800 million to the folks out west. And so those are the kinds of decisions that the legislature is making. When I started as tax commissioner, you know, it was kind of unusual to see a bill with a fiscal note of, say, $10 or $20 million. Now there are bills with $1 billion fiscal notes on them. And so times have changed, and with it has the consequences and proposals of the legislature.
Well, I mentioned that you have a projection there for the current biennium we're in. Again, it's about $4.9 billion. Do you go out any further? Are you looking 5-10 years down the road? Do you have any numbers there?
You know, it's a good question, Doug. We try to stick to the upcoming biennium. There are legislators that would love for us to be able to project farther, but we try to confine our prediction. We are part of what is called the legislative forecasting process. It's driven by the Office of Management and Budget, but we're a big piece of that because we collect the revenue. And we bring in experts from the various industries, and we like to actually stick with the upcoming biennium because anything beyond that can become very uncertain, especially in the area of oil. Oil forecasting is very uncertain. Because it all hinges on, you know, of course, price, and price can be affected by so many factors, global issues that we have no control over, prices issues that we have no control over. So it's something that we really try to confine our projections to the upcoming biennium and not beyond. So,
well, when you look at the property tax history for collections in the state, you notice two things. Obviously, the property tax collections are up, even though we've had some significant decreases in the rate of property tax, the actual tax itself. But you can see the valuations are apparently up. The property valuations.
Valuations are part of that. Also, new property. There's lots of new property and property that was exempt that comes off the tax rolls adds to that. But I think probably one of the biggest contributors to the increased collections of property taxes is obviously in some cases there are more that are being collected as a result of valuations, but also the fact that there's so much new property in certain areas, especially out west. I don't know if you've been out west lately, but you just need to go to communities like Minot and Williston and Watford City and Dickinson, and they look – the whole city looks like a construction zone.
Yes.
And so all of that adds, of course, to that as well.
All right. Well, Corey Fong, North Dakota Tax Commissioner, he is the man with the revenue right now. And you can find out all about it by going online at nd.gov/tax, and you'll see a wealth of information about the state's revenue and about what you need to do to get ready for the tax season. So thank you very much, Corey
Doug,
Fong.
Doug, thanks so much.
Tom Ezrin in a Plain Folk column in a moment.
Tonight's television lineup on Prairie Public starts with a trip back to the 40s, recalling some of the most famous singers of the day in a 2-hour special, Big Band Vocalists. Then at 9 Central, Under the Street Lamp. More songs from yesteryear performed by cast members of the play Jersey Boys. Tune in tonight on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public, and in the background, Count Basie with a G.I. Stomp. That is some big band sound. Okay, now let's change the subject a little bit. We'll have Tom Ezern share his Plains Folk column. It's called Monkey Business.
J. Evetts Haley was not a guy you wanted to cross because he cherished his grudges. Born in 1901, Haley grew up in a family that had a hardware store in Midland, Texas, and a ranch nearby. He grew up doing ranch work, riding in rodeos, and studying history. In fact, he completed an M.A. in history from the University of Texas in 1926. He then wrote a couple of books that established him as one of the great historians of Great Plains Ranching, a history of the legendary XIT Ranch, and a biography of the legendary rancher, Charles Goodnight. Haley, the author, rather resembled Goodnight, his subject. Crusty, not tolerant of fools. With the onset of the Great Depression and of President Roosevelt's New Deal, Haley went to work for the government. He served as director of the Texas Historical Records Survey. He soon became disillusioned with the Roosevelt program, however, and became a vocal anti-New Deal Democrat. He got fired from his records job. After that, Haley managed several different West Texas ranches and remained prominent in public affairs. He ended up on the wrong side of history, running for governor in 1956 on a platform that favored racial segregation. But he sure was a heck of a historian. And in 1934, he wrote an essay published in the Saturday Evening Post that has come to epitomize the rugged individualism of Western ranchers. The title was Cow Business and Monkey Business. "We are in the cow business," Haley writes. "We have preserved something of that independence and love of liberty that have characterized the cow country from its earliest days. In its practical application, liberty, with us, seems to be the right to handle our business in our own way." Haley complained that government programs raising the price of cottonseed and corn were running cattlemen out of the business. The government answer for the cattle business then was to go onto ranches, appraise and condemn drought-starved cattle, kill some of them for canners, and the rest just shoot them and bury them. On the Haley Ranch, cattle were shot worth a 30-30 and left to rot, including valuable veal calves. Haley never got over his anger about this. In my home state of Kansas, the federal government in late 1934 bought 10,000 cattle a day, more than 500,000 total, coming from every county. In North Dakota, county extension agents were involved in the cattle condemnations, and they didn't like it. They did their duty, but they took grisly pictures of the cattle killings and pasted them into their annual reports. None of them outright opposed the program. That might have put them in the same place Haley ended up in Texas. But they let the photos and grim captions speak for them. Evetts Haley maybe just lived too long. His values were those of the open range, values out of place in the middle of the 20th century. But the thing that set him off, the killing and waste of animals, for which ranchers, however hard bitten, feel responsibility of care, it left an ugly scar on the prairie.
That's history professor Tom Ezern. And we're going to go in the news now with Danielle Webster. Danielle, what's on your mind today? What are you talking about?
What's on my mind? Well, we've got Dave Thompson, who's really busy out in Bismarck with the legislature. We've got a few stories today from out that way, and we'll get to that in a little bit here.
All right, here's Danielle with the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Child care providers are asking a state Senate committee to return a child care stabilization bill to its original form. As introduced, the measure would make $15.4 million $1,000 available for grants to child care centers. The House added language that increases the rations of children to teacher. And providers like Marnie Crow of West Fargo don't like it.
North Dakota is never tried to do quantity care. It's always been quality care.
Parents of children in daycare don't like it either, and they say they're willing to pay their share of the child care bill, but they say they're squeezed by the cost. Beth Audelin of Minot has two children in a daycare facility.
It takes two incomes for families to live in North Dakota. So the opportunity for women to stay home with their children no longer exists in many households.
The Senate Human Services Committee has not yet taken action on the bill. The North Dakota Board of Higher Education holds a special meeting Thursday in Bismarck to review allegations the board and university system chancellor Ham Shirvani violated policy and the state's open meeting law. Board President Dwayne Espegard initially said an investigation into the claims would take until May, but he's changed his mind.
As I look at the damage that's being done by something like this, and so I said our number one priority is to investigate these various claims that are out there. And my goodness, there were claims of meetings of not being properly noticed, and there were also claims of even lying on the resume. Put our number one resources into this for the next week here, and hopefully we'll have the information by that time.
Espegard says Shirvani was hired to follow through on plans to modernize the university system, and he says the new chancellor is being used as an easy target by opponents of the idea to make sure that never happens. And the state Senate has turned down one of two measures that would create an outdoor heritage fund to help with access and habitat. This measure would have been put to a vote in 2014 as a constitutional amendment. It would have set aside $100 million a year, and unlike a statutory measure still pending, would have allowed the purchase of land. Fargo Democratic Senator Tyler Axness sponsored the measure. He says people did not get a chance to vote on an initiated constitutional measure last year because of ballot fraud. And he says a number of people approached him to get this on the ballot through legislative action.
What are we concerned about when it comes to allowing the people of the state to vote on things? These are the same people that elected each and every one of us to this chamber. We entrust them to do that. Why don't we entrust them to steer our landscape in the direction that they see fit for our grandchildren?
But senators representing agricultural areas objected to the measure allowing land purchases. Jamestown Republican Senator Terry Wanzek.
$100 million a year that could potentially, at $2,000 an acre, allow an unelected group, to compete with our farmers and ranchers and potentially purchase 50,000 acres per year.
The measure failed 36 to 10. A measure that would set aside $30 million a biennium but not allow land purchases is still pending in the Senate. It has already passed the House. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Thank you, Danielle. That's Main Street's news voice, and you'll be hearing me and Danielle. We'll be chatting every now and then to talk about what's happening in the world of news. Right now, though, we're going to talk to Dr. Glenn Dorsum. He is an assistant professor in biochemistry at NDSU, and he is the fellow who's going to be giving the Science Cafe presentation tomorrow evening at the Hotel Donaldson's Stoker Lounge. That's downstairs. It's at 7 o'clock, and here's a come-on for you from the news release. Designer jeans that won't make you fat and may save your life. That's jeans with a G. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Glenn Dorsum.
Thank you very much.
Well, for laymen like me and lots of our listeners, what is genetic engineering or modification?
Well, in a nutshell, it is taking a human patient who has a genetic disease, which means some type of disease manifestation by a single gene, which encodes or is the blueprint for a single protein that is not working correctly. And scientists now have the ability to insert a DNA antidote, if you will, and swap out the bad DNA sequence for the correct DNA sequence. And that should generate a cure.
What kinds of diseases are we talking about, these genetic diseases?
Most of the genetic diseases have to fall into a certain category. And what that means is there are certain diseases that are caused by multiple factors. And this type of gene therapy would not be a good strategy to treat those diseases. Certain monogenetic diseases, they're called, where one gene is defective that makes a defective protein and therefore that causes the disease. those are much more readily fixable by this technology because there's just one gene that needs to be fixed.
Muscular dystrophy, or is that?
Is one. SCIDs or immunodeficiency. HIV is now being looked into.
Wow.
Viral diseases. The name escapes me at the moment.
Well, how is this done? How is this DNA antidote put in, and how does it work?
Well, if you come to my talk tomorrow, I have a...
That's right, 7 o'clock at Stoker's Lounge at La Hodo.
I have a little race car analogy where scientists use what we call a vector or a vehicle. And this vehicle essentially is a DNA boat or cargo ship, if you will, that carries this antidote DNA piece of DNA, and it delivers them into our cells, typically using viruses. And since we're constantly being infected by viruses, and most of the listeners out there have received or infected by the common cold, viruses infect our cells on a daily basis and deliver their DNA cargo into our cells, and we sort of usurp this technology to deliver whatever we want into the cells.
So we're going to start to think of viruses as pretty good things, huh?
Pretty good things, yeah.
Is it dangerous?
It can be dangerous. The history of this, I've done a little reading, and what I found was just after World War II in 1947, it was first conceptualized by a doctor, I forget his name at the moment. And he was thinking that even before DNA was – the structure of DNA had even been identified by Watson and Crick in 1953, he in the late 40s said, hey, we could probably cure certain diseases by modifying genetic material. I believe in 1990, the first human trial was conducted with some success and some of the – failures. There was a young man who died after receiving this viral concoction with this antidote DNA due to a radical immune response to the virus. The young man went into sort of a shock and died 4 days later. So it can be dangerous, and we don't know all of the ins and outs. And when we're tinkering with Mother Nature, things can go wrong.
All right. Well, if genes are engineered or modified, can they be owned?
It's a good question. I believe people are patenting DNA sequences. Personally, my own opinion, I think it's sort of silly to clone and patent your own gene and own your own gene. But
there's a lot of money involved sometimes.
Yeah, and people have. There's a company out in California, Sangamo Industries, something similar to that, who are buying up all the technology associated with this new gene therapy now that I'll be talking about.
Well, it does raise some ethical concerns.
It does.
I mean, if you put a price tag on a gene or some modification of it, there might be people who can't afford it.
Right. And similar for other medical interventions. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the therapy can be quite expensive.
What about the equipment that's used? Is it just a matter of getting a shot or taking a pill, or what needs mechanically to be done?
Several different strategies are used. One simple way is taking blood samples, and this is called an ex vivo therapy strategy, where you take blood. And if it's a disease such as the SCIDs disease, in which the patient does not have an immune response, a correct immune response, in order to fix the immune response, you take immune cells from the blood outside the body, you introduce the correct gene with the virus vehicle, and the cells that have been properly modified are then reinserted into the host, and that has been effective.
So how close are we to curing diseases and disorders with this?
Based upon my abstract of taking a pill and being cured, by the time you fall asleep to Jay Leno, was probably I probably embellished a bit. But we definitely are close. There are human one trials now with this next generation of what's called zinc finger nucleases, a type of gene therapy that now being heralded as the next coming. We are close where they're called phase one trials. Typically, once we have the data from these trials, HIV, Huntington's disease, and there's a few others, we will assess the information, the toxicity, whether there's these side effects that have been reported. Some patients have received leukemia from this type of treatment. We have to obviously stop that. Within the lifetime, I think, of a college student, that's a guess.
But to think about something as devastating as Huntington's disease or ALS,
right,
which destroy lives and the people around them almost in the process, that would be a breakthrough.
And yet the bubble boy disease, I mean, it was just a single protein that's malfunctioning and we can now fix it.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, taking that pill and then watching Leno. So share a little bit more of the news release because you'll get a sense of how exciting the prospects are. Now, as Professor Dorsum said, we're not quite there yet, but imagine this. Monday morning, you wash down a prescription pill with some orange juice. By lunchtime, a fleet of designer genes released into your bloodstream targets the disease cells and infiltrates them. You order a grand decaf vanilla double shot skinny latte in the afternoon. 5 minutes later, those designer genes have completed their interrogation of the billions of DNA sequences in your disease cells to bind and fix with 100% accuracy the mutated gene causing your disease. By the time you drift off to Jay Leno, your genetic disease is cured. And that does sound like science fiction, but it's conceivable at this point.
It definitely is.
Well, what do you think is the most exciting current news in genetic research?
Oh boy! Well, probably. Well, I guess all professors are intrinsically arrogant. So what I'm doing is pretty exciting.
There you go. But let's share it.
Let's see. In a nutshell, we've just received some NIH funding to look into how a protein in our brain affects fungal allergic asthma. I'm collaborating with a professor, Dr. Jane Hsu, and we now are engaged in these studies. Regarding zinc finger nucleases, I find this to be extremely exciting, the fact that we can actually do this Band-Aid antidote type of strategy to cure us is remarkable. But what is actually interesting is changing our gametes, sperm and eggs. If we were to do this, change the DNA makeup of our sperm cells and or our egg cells, we would actually be affecting future generations. And therein lies some of the ethical implications of this research.
Some might even get into the moral areas as well. So there are some very interesting discussions on the horizon here for that. I am a genetic combination, but mine was natural selection, I think. And what we're talking about is special selection, I suspect. Is genetic engineering growing academically? Because we're going to need lots of people to do this, aren't we?
Yes. I look back on PubMed Central. This is an archive of all the scientific journals that are published now since 1950 or so. And there was a graph since 1968. I did a gene therapy search. 1968 through early 70s, there was about one paper a year. And now there's thousands of papers a year on this subject. So it's definitely gaining in momentum. The death that occurred in 1990, there was a significant pause taken by the scientific community. The Senate, the House of Representatives, they inquired this. But now that we're understanding a little more about the cell and how it works, we're trying again with these zinc finger nucleases, which is sort of the next generation. And the accuracy is phenomenal now, so that's all new.
So how about NDSU? You have lots of majors in this area now, or is it grow? Is it a growth area?
Sure. We have a biochemistry and molecular biology degree now at NDSU. I believe it's in its fifth or sixth year now. I've actually gone from chemistry, biochemistry to veterinary and microbiological sciences just recently. And my collaborator, Dr. Jane Hsu, she is in that department, so that's why I moved over there. We have a microbiology undergraduate degree and zoology, several disciplines that probably overlap what these designer genes and genetic engineering.
Well, let's talk about a little application in agriculture. Obviously, we can make better cows, can't we, and other things?
Yeah, and actually this these zinc finger nucleases have been used in plant cells as well. So we can genetically alter and make hybrid next-generation corn and wheat and soybean plants.
Now, you call them hybrid, but I bet they're a little step beyond hybrid, aren't they?
So, yeah, the new and improved, right.
Okay, but it's also controversial. GMOs are not embraced by everybody. What is the concern there?
It's a good question. I think I'm a little biased when we talk about transgenic organisms in general. Transgenic meaning we're tinkering with the DNA makeup. I tell my students in biochemistry that we are transgenic organisms. Every organism on this biosphere is a transgenic organism simply because we have been constantly been bombarded by viruses throughout our evolution. And 3.5 billion years of evolution, 10 to the 24th viral infections per second or minute, something like that. It's a lot. We've evolved getting all of these DNA sequences. We've integrated into our genome, and we're sort of this makeup of our genes as well as lots of ancient viruses. So we're actually transgenic organisms ourselves. So when we change corn to grow better in a hot environment and then eat it, I don't find it to be a big deal. However, I realize that it is a hot topic for some other people.
Well, again, to go back across the aisle to the human side of this, if we were looking at the ideal human being 6 feet tall and requiring 1,000 calories or whatever a day, again, that would get into some troublesome areas. So obviously, this is an example, I suppose, of a science that's got some technology tied to it that's advancing maybe a little bit faster than our ability to cope with the idea.
I think there's a part of that, yes. And when you talk about breaking down the rules that Mother Nature has put forth, we don't understand how a cell works. So when we try to correct DNA sequences, we don't fully understand all of the parameters associated with that.
Well, now I think I've recently read that there are some scientists that think that the technology and the techniques are in place to clone a human.
Yes.
But you say they're trying because in some countries they can.
Right.
But I don't think they can here.
In the United States, I believe it's not federally funded, at least.
That does raise some interesting issues. Talk about NDSU. Talk about the academic environment you're in. What kinds of guidelines do you have to follow?
When we do human-based research at NDSU, we have to go through a process called an IRB, an Institutional Review Board certification. That typically has a number of professors and individuals from the public that come together, read the proposal. If there are any humans engaged in the research, there has to be consent. There has to be a very detailed description of what the research is going to do. Will there be any pain associated to the person? Will they take any samples? Will they not take samples? What will happen to the samples? If they want to be removed from the study at any time, they have to have that ability. So there has to be a lot of communication with the scientists. So this IRB is a very detailed process, and it's based upon some of the travesties that happened in World War II and Tuskegee.
You're talking about eugenics and that kind of thing.
Yes.
Trying to manipulate the way people look and all that other stuff. Yeah, that's what we're talking about. We're kind of getting into that area, and there's a lot of sorting out that has to be done. It's kind of fun sometimes to do this crystal ball thing, even though we're talking about something that seems so science fiction-y anyway. But I went up on a website that deals with serious issues in genetic research, but also had kind of a fun area where they were talking about things that you might be looking at. And one of the things that occurred to me is that if you can replace genes, I mean, our DNA and our genetic makeup sort of describes the arc of our lives.
Correct.
The aging process. Mm-hmm. So is immortality in the tables here? I mean, eventually if we all get to figuring this out, do we live forever now? Not now, but eventually?
Well, I would probably defer to someone who knows what they're talking about on this subject.
Okay.
But to give an old college try, I suppose our endoskeleton can last for longer than 100 years, I would say, depending upon arthritis and things like that, maybe 200 or so. The ability to replicate and allow for our cells to be healthy from second to second to second, as long as we can maintain that, we should be able to live. But sure, with genetic engineering, we definitely can improve our lives during the time we are alive. Whether it's going to delay the onset of aging by any considerable amount, sure, in a crystal ball, why not?
Okay. How about transplants without the waiting list? We just grow the organ.
Yeah, that's a fascinating new area of research. I'm not that up on this research, but I have seen various specials on television and the ability to grow the organs in a way that there is no immune response when you place them into the body, which is typically one of the major factors that limits organ transplant and is why organs sometimes are rejected. Having some type of inert type of organ that is not rejected by human beings would be a great breakthrough.
Be better than a pig valve for the heart, I
exactly.
take it. But this comes with an expense. I mean, this kind of research can come up with a solution or a treatment that is six figures or more.
Absolutely, yeah. Millions and millions of dollars.
So there's that issue to work through as well.
Right.
Well, if you were – I guess going to encourage people to come to your presentation tomorrow night, what would you tell them that I haven't already told them?
Well, I think that the ability to manipulate our genetic material, the blueprint of who we are, is pretty extraordinary. I'll give a brief history of gene cloning and – or not gene cloning, gene therapy, starting its conceptualization in 1947, and I'll work my way up to 2013. I have some fun facts about how much DNA we have in our body and the ability of these scientists to have to comb through all of these DNA sequences to find the needle in the haystack, that one gene. And in fact, not even the entire gene, just a few – 100 base pairs, which makes up our wow. DNA, our base pairs, and just repeating base pairs, and just remove it and put in the antidote DNA is phenomenal to me. And I'll have a few other fun tidbits about how the cell works and things like that.
Well, thanks for joining us today. It's been fascinating.
Pleasure. Thank
Dr.
you.
Glenn Dorsum is an assistant professor in the Department of
Veterinary and Microbiological Sciences.
Thank you very much. And he is presenting tomorrow evening at the Stoker's Basement in the Hotel Donaldson. That's right downtown Fargo. Now, it is Stoker's Basement. It's a lounge, so you have to be 21 or accompanied by a parent or guardian, but it sounds like a very fascinating talk. Science Cafe at the Hotel Donaldson. More Main Street in a moment.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Attorney Daniel Buchanan of Buchanan Law Office in Jamestown, specializing in elder law and estate planning. Information on these and other legal matters is available at 252-6604.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 11th. 1943 proved a tough tax season for the Fargo Tax Division of the Bureau of Internal Revenue. Division workers headquartered on the second floor of the Fargo Federal Building began processing as many as 20,000 claims a day on this date in 1943 in anticipation of the looming March 15th deadline. With the passage of new tax legislation, more Americans were filing income taxes than ever before. For much of the country's history, income taxes were either non-existent or created for short-term situations, and even then, few Americans actually paid an income tax. In 1939, it was estimated that less than a fifth of American workers filed income taxes. The poor compliance was blamed on the methodology, with the individual worker burdened with the responsibility of reporting their income each year and paying the tax. In 1940, with the prospect of war growing each day, it became clear that federal spending was growing. Between 1940 and 1945, several laws were passed to increase taxes and participation. The 1942 Victory Tax Bill increased income tax on every American worker to help fund the war effort. Two further bills were also passed, the Revenue Bill of 1943 and the Current Tax Payment Act of 1943. The Current Tax Payment Act forever altered the method of income tax collection. From that year on, income taxes would be withheld from each worker's paycheck. With these changes, the number of taxpayers increased from 4 million in 1939 to 50 million in 1945, and the amount of taxes collected increased 20-fold. Many of these changes were first enacted during the 1943 tax season, inundating each state's tax division with first-time filers. The Fargo division was forced to hire an additional 20 collectors to help process the state's record number of claims. With more than 120,000 claims to process, a forum reporter visiting the headquarters on March 11th that year called the tax division the biggest business in town. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jamie Jobe. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public, and I'm joined by Ashley Thornburg. It's our debut day, Ashley. Great to have you with me, as always.
Well, thank you. I always love to be here.
And we should tell people that Main Street wasn't just, you know, somebody didn't just write this down and we went with it. We actually talked about lots of names for a long time and came up with dozens of them. And this one was actually proposed by our producer, Skip Wood, and we kept coming back to it and coming back to it, and that's what we are now.
I like that. I mean, it really is a conversation and something that can evolve over time, much like the show is really going to do itself.
And your contributions are part of the show. As a matter of fact, you've got something coming up tomorrow.
I do. I will be talking with a chemistry professor at Minot State University. Robert Crackle is the name, and he will be working on the Science Olympiad. It's kind of like a track meet for the scientifically minded, and they'll be working on testing their knowledge, lab skills, design, engineering. So I think that's going to be a really interesting interview.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. And tomorrow I get to talk about the U.S.-Dakota War. It was 150 years ago that this was fought between federal troops and the Dakota tribe, and the Center for Heritage Renewal is conducting a reconsideration of that conflict. And Tom Ezern, who does our Prairie Folk columns, will be here. He's involved in that. We're going to be joined by an archaeologist and historian, Richard Rothus, and we're going to hear also from Tamara St. John. She's an archivist for the Sisseton Wahpeton tribe. So looking forward to those discussions. Always looking forward to having Ashley Thornburg with me. We do What's Happening on Thursdays.
We do, yeah. And there's always a lot going on.
There's our new theme music in the background. That guy is...
I'm going to have to learn new dance moves now.
Craig Chakiro. Have a great night.